So, midway we are in this third chapter in Synthesis of Yoga, The Threefold Life, originally published in October 1914. Sri Aurobindo is just beginning to find his rhythm as he writes essays about the practice of yoga in a synthetic way. He's been saying that the picture we have here of the mind wrestling with and withdrawing from matter is, and its difficulties, is part of what the evolution has to pass through to arrive at a greater mastery of consciousness over nature. Ultimately, they are the same reality. But in the early innings of the evolution, as we rise out of the ignorance, then we have to overcome, in the manifestation of life and matter, the obscurities and the restrictions that it imposes upon life and consciousness. So it goes on. So he continues from this point. This mixing with life may, however, be pursued for the sake of the individual mind and with an entire indifference to the forms of the material existence or the uplifting of the race. This indifference is seen at its highest in the Epicurean discipline and is not entirely absent from the Stoic. And even altruism that does the works of compassion more often for its own sake than for the sake of the world it helps. But this too is a limited fulfillment. So first, the Epicurean discipline, which obviously comes from Epicurus, the great atomistic philosopher who lived from 341 to about 270 BCE, believed in the plain facts of life, that the world was a field of atomic interactions, one of the early philosophies that embraced atomism. Empiricism was its method. Hedonism, ultimately, was its goal. But people misunderstand if they think that the Epicureans were luxurious in their approach to life. They were quite the contrary to that. Very fastidious, exacting about how one would deal with the senses so that one would practice austerities, so that when you have an aesthetic experience at some level, it would have a greater impact upon you. So, much misunderstood. So, but indifference was there. Indifference is even more part of the story in the Stoic philosophy, which really comes from Zeno, who passed away around 261 BCE. Stoa means porch. So Zeno would sit on the painted porch in Athens and teach his philosophy, which resolved itself basically into an analysis of logic, an analysis of physics, the nature of the world, and then how one lives. What is the ethic? And the ethic, according to him, was to live according to reason. And reason imposes on the life well-lived simplicity. Simplify your life. Resign. Apatia. From the concerns, the struggles to get ahead in life. Instead, resignation was the approach of the Stoic. So we have this idea of the Stoic indifference, sitting back from the engagement in life, letting everything buffet the being, but not necessarily responding to it, or responding to it with rationality. So you see in this indifference to pleasure and pain, which is characteristic of the Stoic philosophy, something akin to the development of the philosophy in India of samatha, equality to all things. But the indifference imposed in the Greek philosopher, by the Greek philosopher, would have been intellectual upon the members of the being. And the samatha, the equality of spirit in the Gita, is one of deep spiritual placement. So, back to the text. The progressive mind is seen at its noblest when it strives to elevate the whole race to its own level, whether by sowing broadcast the image of its own thought in fulfillment, or by changing the material life of the race into fresh forms, religious, intellectual, social, or political, intended to represent more nearly that ideal of truth, beauty, justice, righteousness, with which the man's own soul is illumined. Failure in such a field matters little, for the mere attempt is dynamic and creative. The struggle of mind to elevate life is the promise and condition of the conquest of life by that which is higher even than mind. So the mind's attempt at this is, in a sense, the opening move in the transformation of life in matter with consciousness with a capital C. That highest thing, the spiritual existence, is concerned with what is eternal, but not therefore entirely aloof from the transient. For the spiritual man, the mind's dream of perfect beauty is realized in an eternal love, beauty, and delight that has no dependence and is equal behind all objective appearances. Its dream of perfect truth in the supreme, self-existent, self-apparent, and eternal verity, which never varies, but explains and is the secret of all variations and the goal of all progress. Its dream of perfect action in the omnipotent and self-guiding law that is inherent forever in all things and translates itself here in the rhythm of the worlds. What is fugitive vision or constant effort of creation in the brilliant self is an eternally existing reality in the self that knows and is the Lord. Perfect truth, satyam, perfect action based upon truth, ritam. So there are echoes here of the Veda. Down here, the brilliant self. Well, that's a reference, obviously, to the earlier citation from the Mandukya Upanishad, brilliant tejasa, what shines. Now, there's a quotation down here from the same Upanishad, the next couple of verses, which says, the unified, eki bhuta, in whom conscious thought is concentrated, prajnana ghana, who is all delight, anandamaya, and enjoyer of delight, ananda bhuk, the wise, prajna, the one who really knows. He is the Lord of all, the omniscient, the inner guide. Esha sarveshwara, esha sarvagnya, esha antaryami. Beautiful, the Sanskrit. Beautiful, the translation. But it is often difficult for the mental life to accommodate itself to the dully resistant material activity. How much more difficult must it seem for the spiritual existence to live on in a world that appears full not of the truth, but of every lie and delusion, not of love and beauty, but of an encompassing discord and ugliness, not of the law of truth, but of victorious selfishness and sin. Therefore, the spiritual life tends easily in the saint and sannyasin to withdraw from the material existence and reject it either wholly and physically or in the spirit. It sees this world as the kingdom of evil or of ignorance, and the eternal and divine either in a far-off heaven or beyond, where there is no world and no life. It separates itself inwardly, if not also physically, from the world's impurities. It asserts the spiritual reality in a spotless isolation. This withdrawal renders an invaluable service to the material life by forcing it to regard and even to bow down to something that is the direct negation of its own petty ideals, sordid cares, and egoistic self-content. So the world contradicts the beauty and the truth which are native to the spirit, and so away we go. We don't like this ugliness, and we won't have anything to do with it. We'll withdraw and renounce the world if necessary. But the fact that the spirit refuses to be encased in ugliness, in error, in ignorance, is a vivid contradiction to life, and that helps waken life to the fact that it must respond to that. So it's an uneasy, a tensive relationship between the spirit doing this, accepting all that is around it without protest, and saying, no, I'll have nothing to do with you. Otherwise, you see, you would have a passive submission to the insufficiencies of nature. At least the sannyasin says, I'll have nothing to do with you. It's not the best or the fullest response, but it is a better response than mere complicity, than merely knuckling under. This also has an echo, obviously, with chapter 2 in The Life Divine. You'll have read that, so. But the work in the world of so supreme a power as spiritual force cannot be thus limited. The spiritual life also can return upon the material and use it as a means of its own greater fullness. Refusing to be blinded by the dualities, the appearances, it can seek in all appearances whatsoever the vision of the same Lord, Isha, the same eternal truth, beauty, love, delight. The Vedantic formula of the self in all things in the self, and all things as becomings of the self is the key to this richer and all-embracing yoga. This is a rough translation of the Isha Upanishad, verses 6 and 7. You'll remember when we studied the Life Divine that we talked much about how the Isha Upanishad, in its short number of verses, was the basis for his own philosophy of Life Divine. In writing this, in October of 1914, he refers to these verses 6 and 7, which he would, 1 month later, comment about. He would translate and interpret these very verses in the Isha Upanishad in the next issue of the Arya. So it was much on his mind, this idea of the oneness of things, That self is in all things. All things are in that single self. All things are becomings. Everything that we see in formal existence, nama, rupa, everything in front of us, becomings of that same self. That's the key, the oneness, the diversity. That's the key to his all-embracing yoga. Refusing nothing, accepting all as a manifestation of the only thing that is, that conscious existence whose nature is delight. Satchit Ananda. But the spiritual life, like the mental, may thus make use of this outward existence for the benefit of the individual with a perfect indifference to any collective uplifting of the merely symbolic world which it uses. Since the eternal is forever the same in all things, and all things the same to the eternal, since the exact mode of action and the result are of no importance compared with the working out in oneself of the one great realization, this spiritual indifference accepts, no matter what environment, no matter what action, dispassionately prepared to retire as soon as its own supreme end is realized. It is so that many have understood the ideal of the Gita. Or else, the inner love and bliss may pour itself out on the world in good deeds and service and compassion, the inner truth and the giving of knowledge, without therefore attempting the transformation of a world which must, by its inalienable nature, remain a battlefield of the dualities, of sin and virtue, of truth and error, of joy and suffering. So we can simply accept to be, and in that state of indifference, whatever happens, happens. Or we can try to do good works and pour out what we can through our limited being for whatever time we remain on earth from within that state of spiritual illumination. And yet, it does little good because it does not aim at transformation. Until we change the rules of the game goes on. But if progress also is one of the chief terms of world existence, and a progressive manifestation of the divine, the true sense of nature, this limitation also is invalid. It is possible for the spiritual life in the world, and it is its real mission to change the material life into its own image, the image of the divine. Therefore, besides the great solitaries who have sought and attained their self-liberation, we have the great spiritual teachers who have also liberated others, and supreme of all, the great dynamic souls who, feeling themselves stronger in the might of the spirit than all the forces of the material life banded together, have thrown themselves upon the world, grappled with it in a loving wrestle, and striven to compel its consent to its own transfiguration. Ordinarily, the effort is concentrated on a mental and moral change in humanity, but it may extend itself also to the alteration of the forms of our life and its institutions, so that they too may be a better mold for the inpourings of the Spirit. These attempts have been the supreme landmarks in the progressive development of human ideals and the divine preparation of the race. Every one of them, whatever its outward results, has left earth more capable of heaven and quickened in its tardy movements the evolutionary yoga of nature. all insights, all religious and spiritual efforts have helped in some regard to vivify and illuminate nature. And through all of these, the yoga of nature, the cosmic yoga, is conducting itself. She, who is that conscious power, Chit Shakti, is invariably at work in every event, in every circumstance, in every thread of becoming, in every awakening and developing soul, pushing, pulling, encouraging, revealing what we may be. In India, for the last 1,000 years and more, the spiritual life and the material have existed side by side to the exclusion of the progressive mind. Spirituality has made terms for itself with matter by renouncing the attempt at general progress. It has obtained from society the right of free spiritual development for all who assume some distinctive symbol, such as the garb of the sannyasin, the recognition of that life as man's goal, and those who live it as worthy of an absolute reverence, and the casting of society itself into such a religious mold that its most customary acts should be accompanied by a formal reminder of the spiritual symbolism of life and its ultimate destination. On the other hand, there was conceded to society the right of inertia and immobile self-conservation. The concession destroyed much of the value of the terms. The religious mold being fixed, the formal reminder tended to become a routine and to lose its living sense. The constant attempts to change the mold by new sects and religions ended only in a new routine or a modification of the old, for the saving element of the free and active mind had been exiled. The material life handed over to the ignorance, the purposeless and endless duality, became a leaden and dolorous yoke from which flight was the only escape. So far as religious life had impact on society. The schools of Indian yoga lent themselves to the compromise. Individual perfection or liberation was made the aim, seclusion of some kind from the ordinary activities, the condition, the renunciation of life, the culmination. The teacher gave his knowledge only to a small circle of disciples, or if a wider movement was attempted, it was still the release of the individual soul that remained the aim. The pact with an immobile society was, for the most part, observed. The utility of the compromise in the then actual state of the world cannot be doubted. It secured in India a society which lent itself to the preservation and the worship of spirituality. A country apart, in which, as in a fortress, the highest spiritual ideal could maintain itself in its most absolute purity, unoverpowered by the siege of the forces around it. A great achievement. What country has a greater spiritual heritage than India? He continues, but it was a compromise, not an absolute victory. The material life lost the divine impulse to growth. The spiritual preserved by isolation its height and purity, but sacrificed its full power and serviceableness to the world. Therefore, in the divine providence, the country of the yogins and the sannyasins has been forced into a strict and imperative contact with the very element it had rejected, the element of the progressive mind, so that it might recover what was now wanting to it. You can read into this that indeed, Kala, the time spirit, acting at the behest, empowering the will of the Chit Shakti, has now forced this development upon India as a furtherance of the Sanatana Dharma. She has no choice but to rejoin the world. And now, with India coming back into the world, we see her recovering her lost riches, we see her recovering her lost sovereignty, establishing unity in the midst of diversity, standing regal in the world with some of the greatest promise of all humanity waiting before it. But she must recover fully her spiritual heritage. We have to recognize once more that the individual exists not in himself alone, but in the collectivity. And that individual perfection and liberation are not the whole sense of God's intention in the world. The free use of our liberty includes also the liberation of others and of mankind. The perfect utility of our perfection is, having realized in ourselves the divine symbol, to reproduce, multiply, and ultimately universalize. And ultimately universalize it in others. Therefore, from a concrete view of human life in its threefold potentialities, we come to the same conclusion that we had drawn from an observation of nature in her general workings and the three steps of her evolution. And we begin to perceive a complete aim for our synthesis of yoga. Spirit is the crown of universal existence. Matter is its basis. Mind is the link between the two. Spirit is that which is eternal. Mind and matter are its workings. Spirit is that which is concealed and has to be revealed. Mind and body are the means by which it seeks to reveal itself. Spirit is the image of the Lord of the yoga. Mind and body are the means he has provided for reproducing that image in phenomenal existence. All nature is an attempt at a progressive revelation of the concealed truth, a more and more successful reproduction of the divine image. So God grows up in the course of the cosmic manifestation and its evolution. But what nature aims at for the mass in a slow evolution, yoga effects for the individual by a rapid revolution. It works by a quickening of all her energies, a sublimation of all her faculties. While she develops the spiritual life with difficulty and has constantly to fall back from it for the sake of her lower realizations, the sublimated force, the concentrated method of yoga, can attain directly and carry with it the perfection of the mind, and even, if she will, the perfection of the body. Nature seeks the divine in her own symbols. Yoga goes beyond nature to the Lord of nature, beyond the universe to the transcendent, and can return with the transcendent light and power, with the fiat of the omnipotent. A fiat from the Latin is a solemn, sincere, intentioned command. This shall be done. So here, Sri Aurobindo, without saying it, invites us to the supernature of the Bhagavad Gita. Not simply do we strive for this perfection within the field of Prakriti, but we rise to the supreme nature of the divine, into paraprakriti, and bring its truth down here, fulfilling its command that it wishes to manifest here and now. But their aim is one in the end. The generalization of yoga in humanity must be the last victory of nature over her own delays and concealments. Even as now, by the progressive mind and science, she seeks to make all mankind fit for the full development of the mental life, so by yoga must she inevitably seek to make all mankind fit for the higher evolution, the second birth, the spiritual existence. And as the mental life uses and perfects the material, so will the spiritual use and perfect the material and the mental existence as the instruments of a divine self-expression. The ages when that is accomplished are the legendary Satya or Krita Yugas, the ages of the truth manifested in the symbol, of the great work done when nature in mankind, illumined, satisfied, and blissful, rests in the culmination of her endeavor. It is for man to know her meaning, no longer misunderstanding, vilifying, or misusing the Universal Mother, and to aspire always by her mightiest means to her highest ideal. So, yoga cannot be simply an individual extraction from the world or simply an individual perfection within the world. It must extend widely, broadly into the self that is everywhere, to that omnipresent reality. We have to change society as much as we have to change ourselves. The Shakti's embedded significance becomes clear in nature's evolution. Our aspiration, as it grows and quickens, keeps us in attunement with her and in pace with her strides. Satya means truth. Krita, affected or completed. That's the end of this chapter. Next week, we take up, what is it, the systems of yoga. And we'll come first to Hatha Yoga, and then to Raja Yoga, and then to the Trimarga, the threefold path of the Gita. And I think we will deliberately look in some depth at each one of these paths in their historical setting. So don't expect to read the entire chapter. We're going to go a little slowly. We'll talk for some time about Hatha Yoga, and we'll talk for some time about Raja Yoga, etc. So be patient. We're not racing through this next chapter. It's dessert. So, if you'll permit me, I'm going to continue from where we were reading last week. This again is in Book 11, the Book of Everlasting Day, the Soul's Choice and the Supreme Consummation. Page 681. A third spirit stood behind, their hidden cause. A mass of superconscience closed in light, creator of things in his all-knowing sleep. All from his stillness came as grows a tree. He is our seed and core, our head and base. All light is but a flash from his closed eyes. The all-wise truth is mystic in his heart. The omniscient ray is shut behind his lids. He is the wisdom that comes not by thought. His wordless silence brings the immortal word. He sleeps in the atom and the burning star. He sleeps in man and God and beast and stone. Because he is there, the inconscient does its work. Because he is there, the world forgets to die. He is the center of the circle of God. He, the circumference of nature's run. His slumber is an almightiness in things. Awake, he is the eternal and supreme. Above was the brooding bliss of the infinite, its omniscient and omnipotent repose, its immobile silence, absolute and alone. All powers were woven in countless concords here. The bliss that made the world in his body lived. Love and delight were the head of the sweet form. In the alluring meshes of their snare, recaptured, the proud, blissful members held all joys, outrunners of the panting heart, and fugitive from life's outstripped desire. Whatever vision has escaped the eye, whatever happiness comes in dream and trance, the nectar spilled by love with trembling hands, the joy the cup of nature cannot hold, had crowded to the beauty of his face, were waiting in the honey of his laugh. Things hidden by the silence of the hours, the ideas that find no voice on living lips, the soul's pregnant meeting with infinity had come to birth in him and taken fire. The secret whisper of the flower and star revealed its meaning in his fathomless look. His lips curved eloquent like a rose of dawn, his smile that played with the wonder of the mind and stayed in the heart when it had left his mouth, glimmered with the radiance of the morning star, gemming the wide discovery of heaven. His gaze was the regard of eternity. The spirit of its sweet and calm intent was a wise home of gladness and divulged the light of the ages in the mirth of the hours, a sun of wisdom in a miracled grove. In the orchestral largeness of his mind, all contrary seekings their close kinship knew. Rich-hearted, wonderful to each other met in the mutual marveling of their myriad notes, and dwelt like brothers of one family who had found their common and mysterious home. As from the harp of some ecstatic god, there springs a harmony of lyric bliss, striving to leave no heavenly joy unsung, such was the life in that embodied light. He seemed the wideness of a boundless sky. He seemed the passion of a sorrowless earth. He seemed the burning of a worldwide sun. Two looked upon each other. Soul saw soul. So, what do you say? Shall we try to bring that here? Have you something better in mind? Something better to do? Come to the adventure. Namaste. Jai Ma.